Good day, everyone. Welcome to Protocol 80 Over Coffee. We accidentally missed last week's podcast, so we do apologize. Hopefully we didn't lose a slew of listeners. I'm sure we didn't.
All of you that had a ruined weekend because you didn't get to listen to our podcast, we sincerely apologize.
Should be noted this week, Protocol 80 over Twizzlers.
Over Twizzlers. So if you hear smacking, it's me eating Twizzlers.
Not regular Twizzlers, though. They're like fruity flavored ones.
They're rainbow ones. They're fabulous. I wish you could have them right now. I'm going to go first because I have to go and clear the driveway so all the employees can get out. Because we got a gazillion inches of snow.
With your snowmoblower.
With my snowmoblower, which has two working tires now. So my first post this week was on Facebook. They allowed you to use their proprietary markup language called FBML before if you wanted to create apps for Facebook or custom tabs for Facebook. And they have announced that they're doing away with FBML. You could always use an iframe instead of FBML, but it was not accepted in every instance. But now that will be the de facto standard. So basically, what an iframe is a window in one website that shows another website through it. So if you think about Facebook where your wall is, replace that wall with like a peephole that looks through and sees your website behind it. That's basically what an iframe is. Marketers are going to love this because they have control over design. They have control over tracking. They have control over conversion tracking and conversion setup much easier than they did with FBML. So this is a much welcomed change by Facebook. And I said that marketers rejoice because we're all so happy. The other nice thing is it allows you to repurpose elements of your website, your current website, and use them on Facebook because, as you know, if you're looking at a brand's page on Facebook, the last thing you want to do is leave Facebook and go to their website. Well, now you don't have to. You can just stay on a custom tab or somewhere else on Facebook that is showing elements of your small business website. So that's pimptacular. My second post this week, which actually went up today, was Google hates your content farm and will punish you. They just announced some major changes to their algorithm last night around 6 o'clock. It was on a Google blog that they are now going to negatively rank, or I guess reduce the rank of sites that they think are content farms, or sites that are basically useless to users and are set up solely for the purposes of ranking well in search engines. You might be saying, well, everybody's website is set up to rank well in search engines. But that's not really the sole purpose of your website. The real purpose of your website is to help current customers, give them the information they need, products, services, whatever, the functionality that they're after, and give prospects enough bait to hopefully become customers. So really the main purpose is not just to rank well in search engines, but a content farm website, really, that's the only thing they're trying to do. Is rank well maybe for gambling or online poker or something like that. So content farms typically have a bunch of really illegible, sometimes it's legible, but usually illegible content that's not really well written. A lot of times it's scraped from other websites and pasted there and stolen. So Google's doing the right thing here by saying content farms should not outrank a business website that is working hard to write good content, share new information, and do their best to provide the user the best content possible. I did say in my post that I think this is gonna open up there's probably already a huge appeals process with Google and sites that don't rank as well as they should or have been delisted, but I'm sure this is going to increase that tremendously. Just because there seems to be like an element of opinion in some of these. Because, what if the website just really sucks and the person really can't write and they're not copying content, but it's just a terrible website. But they happen to be, the highest ranking for a certain topic. Maybe they don't know how to write, so they're really good at or they write a lot about hanging out on their couch all day and playing video games off the state's money. So maybe they write about that on a daily basis, and they should rank first for taking advantage of the state's money or something like that. But Google ranks them lower because they are uneducated and don't write well. And it looks like a content farm. You know, there is some element of opinion there, right?
I think in most cases, especially regarding that, if it's a big deal, the person will follow up. Like if it's that, I don't think it's going to be as much of a problem for smaller sites like that where maybe they're not really someone who monitors the traffic that they get. But if it is like a small business and for whatever reason they get listed, that person can take it up with Google and I'm sure they'll be happy to resolve that. I think I'm just happy about this from a user experience perspective, because the most annoying thing ever is when you search for something and you think, oh good, especially when you're working on a problem and you like, you're searching for like a code, a snippet of code or something and you find a website that has that, you click through and it has just that text, no relevant content, and then you're basically wasted your time. So hopefully that'll take care of some of those sort of problems.
There have been discussions, I guess, based on the growth of blogging and people creating content for the purposes of inbound marketing, and that search engines are becoming actually less relevant because there's so many blog posts that are taking up a lot of the top positions. So if I'm looking for, I don't know, a product manual for a specific vacuum, yet there's this company out there that blogs about vacuums all the time, and instead of finding that product manual first, I end up finding this guy's blog post about how to change a belt for whatever vacuum cleaner. To a certain extent, I kind of agree. But at the same time, blog posts are ranked the same way as sites are. You're more likely to get ranked higher if you have links to your site and it's good quality content, and you're basically building that reputation with the blog post and your blog. It's not just one guy out there that creates one blog post and then automatically starts ranking for Hoover vacuums.
Right. I think Google did the right thing here, and they're focusing on their mission of providing the most accurate and most valuable results to their users. One thing to keep an eye out for is SEO services you might be using now that use these practices, because I'm sure it won't be long before the algorithm learns associations. So maybe, I wrote about JCPenney's doing some shady things with their SEO last week or a couple weeks back. And what if they were also involved with setting up content farms to drive traffic? You know, I'm sure at some point you'll be guilty by association if you were involved with a content farm, even if you don't own the site specifically.
I think a lot of small businesses are definitely going to have to pay attention to this. We've talked to small businesses that are getting links. They're hiring someone to do their linking for them, and they just end up going to a link farm. But these small businesses have no idea. Mm-hmm. They have no idea that these link farms are even bad.
Right.
So I think that you'll see some small businesses that are hiring someone to do content for them, and all this content is coming from a content farm, primarily without them knowing.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a tough thing, because on the one hand, you want to constantly have new content. And obviously, we're not the only ones that know that. Everyone who knows about SEO and search engine optimization and so forth, they know that too. And so it's just, you know, all this content is constantly being created. And especially like Josh said in the Hoover vacuum example, it's one of those things that I think is just going to happen. And I don't know if that is something that Google should monitor, or I don't really know. So
at some point, it wouldn't surprise me if it becomes a social element of searching where it's more user-based. Like, enough people have reported the site is absolutely terrible and should not be ranked.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm going to take off so I can get these guys out of here at 4:30, because it usually takes me a little over a half hour to clear the driveway. So, leave a comment or something if they say something bad about me.
I'm going to go ahead and I'll jump in next. My first post was on Monday, and it's kind of a follow-up to a topic that I spoke about in the last podcast. I had a news item in that podcast when I just kind of mentioned a little bit about the character limit length on Twitter and whether that's a factor. And after that, I read two blog posts, one that said in order for Twitter to kind of break through into the mainstream more than they have, I think they have like 7% of Americans are on Twitter, whereas compared to Facebook, I'm not sure the exact figure, but it's a much larger
100%.
You heard it here first. So it was just kind of saying that in order for Twitter to break through into the popularity that Facebook has achieved, they kind of have to do away with the 140 character limit thing. And then after that, I read a follow-up post by someone else who said, no, there are other things that Twitter can address first, and that's kind of one of the nice things about Twitter and so forth. So I just kind of wanted to reiterate some of my opinions on that. First of all, let me say that I actually like the 140 character limit. I think that it kind of makes Twitter stand out. It's just a identifying feature, changes the way people have to use it, you know, the type of content that they post to it. But there are some legitimate reasons why they started off that way. I think that's one thing that people don't really understand a lot of the time is, okay, they use this 140 character limit thing, but why is that? Is there a reason for that? And so I went into a little bit about that in my blog post. So the original reason for that was because Twitter was meant to be a communications platform on mobile devices, and the most common way people communicate on their mobile devices is through texting. The most common character limit in a text for one text is 160 characters, so when you add like a Twitter username to that, it rounds out to about 140, so that's why they came with that. They have that so that you can subscribe to someone's tweets on your phone, get a tweet, and it'll be able to come through in one text message. So that's kind of the reason that there is the 140 character limit. And honestly, like I said, the reason I like it is because it kind of sets Twitter apart. I mentioned this before. When you're looking at where you're going to post your content, Twitter's a lot better for doing a quick thought, sort of just a mention of a topic, or maybe you're reposting a link or something like that, whereas it's more likely that you'll post that content to Twitter and then that will be a launching point for maybe a blog or something like that. And I also think that it kind of attributes to a different post I did where there's becoming this like headline economy that I've noticed where people kind of intake news, especially through Twitter, based on headlines. And so that's another thing to keep in mind is you have to pay a little more attention on Twitter to what you're linking to and how you go about linking it and some of the terminology you use when you're posting out a headline. So say you're just reposting a link to your latest blog post, you're all happy about that. And just like kind of the terminology and the words that you use in order to get people to click through, whether it's on Twitter or even on Facebook, they click that link to go to your blog and actually read the entire post. How do you feel about Twitter? Do you think it could be better with a unlimited character limit? Or
no, I think that the 140 is perfect. I taught a class yesterday, just like kind of an entry-level social media class for business, and around this area, Twitter is still very new. We're in a small town, very rural. Not very many people are using it here, so it's kind of a different take on Twitter around right here, I think, than if you were to go to a big city where a lot more people are using it. And I kind of explain that as it's not interruptive whatsoever. So if I miss a couple days, I don't feel the need to go back and say, well, what did I miss?
Right.
I don't have to read anything, really. Mm-hmm. I can just look through if something really catches my attention. Like you said, I'll click through, read the blog post. I think if you were to start having more and more characters, the important stuff would end up getting lost towards the end.
Right.
And I don't know how they're showing this now. Is it like the 140 and then dot, dot, dot?
I believe so, yeah. And that's one thing that I also mentioned is that if they did open up to, you know, I don't know, even if they put a bigger character limit, I think that there's always, as long as there's a character limit, there's going to be someone who bumps up against that, and it's always going to be a problem. So in order to get rid of that, I guess the only way you could really do that is by making it unlimited. And at that point, just to, like, keep up with what people are posting would take forever. It's just, it's not a manageable
platform.
It would
just go back to, like, if I was opening my RSS reader,
yep,
and
exactly.
I put like all subscriptions,
right,
and wanted to read every single one.
Right, it's not efficient for especially the way I use it. I use it like kind of as a news platform, so it's not at all efficient for that.
And I think consider some of the people that we follow, like HubSpot. They post several times a day, and mm-hmm. pretty much every one of them is like a blog post. I don't see them posting these giant tweets that are
right.
a blog post, but there's definitely going to be people out there that are.
Yeah,
going to take advantage of that, and I think you'll have a lot more people that are just spamming Twitter
mm-hmm.
Just to kind of get those search results when they're actually showing in the real-time search and elsewhere. But I think that it should stick to the 140.
Me too. And just to touch on something you mentioned real quickly, I know that especially in our area, Twitter hasn't taken off as much as Facebook, especially because Facebook does have a larger user share, and a lot of people have friends that are already on Facebook, and maybe Twitter's a little more imposing. But I do want to mention that the tools that we use to post things to Facebook are usually so easily expanded to posting to Twitter. So we've mentioned some of these tools, but things like TweetDeck, Seismic, there's a ton of tools out there that make it really easy to post one thing to Facebook and then simultaneously post that to Twitter. And from a small business perspective, and from a perspective of getting as many eyeballs as possible on the content you create, whether that's blog posts or web pages or whatever it may be, I think that even if you're not really sure about Twitter and you don't really understand it, it's always an excellent avenue to get maybe a few more people just to take a look at what you're making or what you're putting out there and get a few more people to visit your site and maybe create a conversion off of that. So I wouldn't discount it if you're not familiar with it, I guess. So
I hope it picks up a little more in the rural areas.
Me too.
Like if you were to go to a big city, if you were in Chicago and you were looking for a restaurant and you did a hashtag Chicago restaurants or Chicago,
right?
There's a good chance that you're going to get someone that responds to you and is like, well, go eat here, go eat here.
Yep.
But around here, if I were to do that,
you'd be waiting.
It would go months before yeah. someone responded.
Yeah.
But they would probably still respond to me.
Yep, eventually. Months later. Yeah. Maybe so, when you were moved on and were in Chicago again.
After all of the urban areas and bigger cities have forgot about it, then people here in right. Bradford and rural areas will start tweeting.
Right.
That's when it's cool.
So that was my first blog post of the week. Josh, would you like to talk about yours?
Yeah, I've been doing a MailChimp series. I don't remember when I started that, if we had talked about my initials. I started out the series just trying to get small businesses to really understand what email marketing was and use Seth Godin's term, permission marketing, where these people are trusting you with their email address, so you need to be sending them good content.
Right.
Then I moved on to importing lists into your MailChimp account. And this is another thing where I think small businesses are a little misunderstood about email marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's permission marketing, so if I'm a member of the chamber or I'm a member of Pioga, just because I might have access to an entire list from that specific chamber or whatever, that doesn't mean that I can just add them to my email marketing list.
Right.
Basically, the way MailChimp explains it is they actually have to opt in. So they buy a product from you, and then there's like a little button that says, I want to receive news and updates, or they're just reading your website, they're reading your blog, and they're like, well, I want newsletters from these people. Let me opt in. I think that that's gone pretty misunderstood for a long time. I know it's nice to have that big list at first, but you'll be much better off just starting out slow and building that list naturally. And if you actually have good things to say and you're mailing out good things, your list will grow.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the if you build it, they will come type that's of right. thing. You just have to have good content. If you're just emailing stuff out there that's rubbish, you're not going to grow your list
right.
whatsoever.
Right.
But then I moved on to templates,
mm-hmm.
Which I think are vital. This day and age, we are inundated with advertising everywhere. You know, from your television to your mobile to everywhere on your computer, even your Gmail.
Yep.
It's just everywhere. Every site seems to be sending some sort of advertising, and then you still have your traditional advertising with ads in newspapers, magazines, billboards, just all over the place. So one of the key things that you have to make sure you're doing is carrying that cohesive branding across everywhere that you're doing that. So even as small as just the colors that you're using, keeping those consistent, using the same logo everywhere, making sure that your logo's on your template, which I'm sure that there's people out there that don't even add their logo to their template just because it's easier,
right.
To like a tagline. And the example I used, if you're from Western New York or around here, I guess within the Buffalo market probably, you've heard the William Matar commercials, the hurt in a car, call William Matar.
Yeah.
444-4444.
Yep, and just to touch on that, like a lot of people think that's annoying, and it is.
It is annoying.
But it's because it's annoying that it sticks in your head, so that's one thing with advertising. And I think, do you remember the head-on commercials?
Well,
it was like for like some headache, something, and it would go, head-on, apply directly to your head. Head-on, apply directly to your head. And it would just say that over and over. It's annoying, but you remember it. And then the next time you have a headache, there's a chance that you might go pick up their product.
So. The other one that comes to my mind is for Hyundai of Grand Island. They have like these car infomercials. They're pretty similar to every other car infomercial that you see, but the owner, I guess he's the owner.
Yeah, Fusillo, I think is his name.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. He always says that his savings are huge.
Yeah. You should check out, just a side note, if you're ever bored, go to YouTube.com and look for Fusillo outtakes. It's pretty funny.
So, while they may not have even thought about that being something with their branding ahead of time, I remember them now.
Right.
I don't think I'll ever buy a car from them, but... Mm-hmm. Maybe. You never know.
Yep.
I might think of them. Mm-hmm. I just think it might be a little far for me to drive to just buy a car when there's going to be a few other dealerships closer.
Yeah. Well, if you lived in that area.
If I lived in the area, yeah. I probably would.
Absolutely.
I would actually ask for him and have him say that to me.
Right.
So back to the topic. Your branding is just, it's vital. And for as easy as it is, to carry your branding over to your email marketing template, I don't think there's any reason that you should go without that. So I just kind of went through the steps on how I did it. Mm-hmm. I always add the logo first, whether I'm doing it for us or a client. I think it helps you build the other colors around that. So you have your logo there, and then you say, well, my logo's here. Should I make my background dark or should I make it light? And then have the body be light versus dark, and vice versa.
Right.
I think that the key factor is to just go in there and play around with the colors. Mm-hmm. You can't mess anything up, and I can't really go and give you like a secret formula to making the perfect email marketing template. The one big benefit that I have when I'm creating it is I'm somewhat familiar with Photoshop, so I can get the hexadecimal colors pretty easily. I think there will be a lot of small businesses out there that don't know how to get that color code. MailChimp does a good job with at least giving you some choices, and you can pull the little...
Like a little picker.
Yeah. So you can somewhat match your colors, but I tried to explain a little bit in there of how to pick or see the hexadecimal color. So if you have Windows 7, I would just recommend to go and grab the snipping tool. So go down to your start menu, start typing snipping, click on the snipping tool, open it up, take a shot of whatever the website you're modeling your email marketing template off of, just grab that screenshot, press copy on the snipping tool, open Photoshop, do Control N to open a new one, and Control V. What's going to happen is it'll paste that copied snipping tool image in there, and then take the dropper tool to the left. It looks like a medicine dropper.
Yep.
Like if you're going to give your kid amoxicillin, the bubblegum medicine. You just pick that, and then go to the color that you want, and click on that, and a little box will pop up. And look towards the bottom of that box, and there'll be like the pound sign, and then a six number letter combination.
Yep, alphanumeric code.
you can just use that right in MailChimp, so you have the exact colors for your branding. A lot of bigger corporations or a lot of companies that have gone through branding strategies will have a list
yep.
and say, well, these are our... hexadecimal colors, or even if it's in RGB values, you can take that and convert RGB to hexadecimal. So I think it's vital, and it'll be something where there's going to be small businesses out there that are just going to go look through the templates that are on MailChimp, and they're fine. but I think you need to brand it to your business. You're marketing your business. You're not marketing how good someone else can make a template,
right. So. I would say it's smart that you said that you should start with your logo, because no matter what,
your logo is always going to be the same. And like you said, it's so easy to build around that once you have it there. You can kind of compare different colors and different design elements to the logo. So I think that's really smart. And also, I just want to touch on the snipping tool. I think that's like one of the most underrated tools in Windows.
I agree. I use it all the time.
Me too. I have it pinned to my start bar. That's how often I use it. And I don't think very many people know about that. So
no, I talk to small businesses out there quite a bit that I show them that. And they're like, oh, this is wonderful.
Absolutely.
Prior to Windows, I think it came in Vista. Didn't it?
Yep.
Prior to Vista, I used Snagit. Have you ever used Snagit?
I haven't, no.
It's more powerful than Snipping Tool, but you know, you have to pay for Snagit, and Snipping Tool's right there, and it's so easy to use.
Yep. So if you're using Windows Vista or Windows 7, hit your Windows key and type snip, and it'll show up there, and you can try it out. That's really good, especially if you do anything with design where you can kind of get a quick screenshot. So that's a very good tip. Good job, Josh.
Thank you.
My next or second post of the week was about how social media is kind of giving way to the rebirth of small town business. And this is kind of a convoluted post, and it might take me a little while to explain. And it's more of a thought that I had than anything else. But kind of analyzing the way people hear about small businesses and things like that over the past maybe 100 years, I got to thinking about this. So maybe in the early 1900s, things were really based around small town and small businesses. So because people didn't really have the ability to travel much or very far beyond their immediate surroundings, they relied upon the small businesses, whether that was, you know, for food or clothing that were right there. And there was a much bigger focus on families. So if, say, your parents always, you went to Sam's Groceries to get their groceries, there was a good chance that you went there too. And Sam knew that by having a good customer relationship with you and your family, that he'll be able to keep you guys as a customer. And if he screws up and maybe his produce is off one day, he won't just lose you as a customer. He'll lose, you know, maybe your family. And, you know, if you lose 10 people in that scenario, that's a significant part of your client base. So that's how things were then. And then as people kind of got the ability to travel, as cars became cheaper, as highways started going up, there was a big push to move into the suburbs. So people kind of spread out a little bit, and they didn't have that close communications where maybe you didn't go to the same store that your parents went to or your families or members or friends went to. And so kind of some of that communication broke down where it wasn't as big of a deal. If you had a bad experience, sure, that was bad, and nobody ever wants to kind of slack on customer experience and customer relations, but maybe they wouldn't have as big of a impact on their overall business. Again, if Sam's Grocery turned into a Sam's Club, and maybe you had a really bad experience at a Sam's Club, but you didn't really have a whole lot of people to tell because there weren't a whole lot of people going to that same store because they've lived across town or across state or whatever. So there wasn't as much of a push on, you know, having that really close, intimate experience. But now, with the birth of social media tools like Facebook and Twitter, whereas Sam's Grocery might have had to worry about losing 5 or 10 customers, nowadays people, I think the average Facebook user has something like 130 friends. So if you have one poor experience, that person can say, hey, these guys are terrible. I went to this Italian restaurant and the food was bad and the place was dirty. Don't ever go here. And in a second, you know, 130 people can see that, and you can be out those 130 people or potential customers. So I just kind of wanted to touch on that. I mentioned in the blog post, there's a really great book that I'm looking forward to that's coming out. And I've spoken about Gary Vaynerchuk a couple times here on the podcast, and I really love his approach to business. And he's working on a book that's, I think, due out in March called The Thank You Economy. And it kind of talks about how we're reverting back to this older style of business, and especially small business, where you have to be sure to not only care about your customers more than maybe you had in the past. Like I said, it's always important to focus on the customer experience and customer service, but more about how the social tools that everyone's using these days are kind of becoming a big factor in that, and that being involved in what people post, especially to your Facebook profile or how they follow up to any of the content you're creating online, how important that is. So I don't know if you had anything to add there. That's kind of my thoughts in general, that it's really important to have at least some sort of strategy. And I think that's going to only grow moving forward.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned like how someone could post something to their Facebook wall and say, whatever, I had the worst experience at so-and-so. One of the big, I don't even know how to put this. One of the big things the small businesses want to say when we talk to them about social media is, well, what if someone says something bad about us? Well, they can say something bad about you whether or not you're involved with social media or not.
Yep.
The one nice thing is if you are involved, you can address it.
Absolutely.
Even if it's a bad review on your Facebook wall, you can address it right there. Show everyone else that's following you that you do address things like that. You can't just start giving away free meals to everyone
right.
if you're a restaurant because everyone's just going to complain so they get a free meal. But you can say, well, hey, thank you for your feedback. We're working on this. Mm-hmm. Next time you're in, let us know how it was, blah, blah, blah. It helps you if you're active within social media, whether you're scared of bad comments or not, to at least have some reputation management there. So, yep.
And I think that's an extremely underrated position for businesses to take. I know that I've certainly reviewed things in the past. One of my favorite websites right now that I use all the time is actually a music service called RDO. You can check it out at RDO.
RDIO.
RDIO.com. It's radio without the A, basically. And I was using a trial of their service, and I kind of reviewed it on my blog and just said, you know, here are some of the things I like, but then here are some of the things that I don't like as much. And I was kind of planning on just having my trial membership run out and not really becoming a customer. But after I posted that, I reposted the link to Twitter and just did use, like, hashtag RDO. And someone from that company, you know, came to my blog, read the post, and actually followed up and said, hey, we're sorry to hear that, you know, you're seeing these issues. Maybe you want to take a look at this instead and maybe try this instead, and we're working on it. And after that, you know, just to see that they were that involved, to kind of follow up and say, you know, thank you for at least trying it out. Maybe you're not 100% happy, right. but we're working to improve the service. Just knowing that they're, you know, taking my feedback into consideration was huge. And I've been paying for my RDO subscription ever since, and I love it. So I think that's one thing that small businesses especially can underrate is just being present and, you know, replying to comments or whatever or content that people are creating about your service or product can be a big thing. And you can actually win customers that way. I know that that certainly happened with me. So
yeah. Do you know their Twitter username? Is it at RDIO?
I believe so. And if you do pound RDO, I'm sure you can search on that and then you can find them. So
make sure you follow them and check out the service.
Yeah, I love it. I know that Josh was a big fan of Lala back then.
I do miss Lala. Mm-hmm. There's certain features that I think have not been yet reproduced by anyone.
Right.
I've tried out Groove Shark and a couple other ones. I would say that RDO is probably right now the next best after Lala when that existed.
There was another one that I heard about this week. This is kind of getting off topic, but I can't remember what it was called. It was supposed to be a mix of RDO and Pandora. I think it was free, and it was more based on Pandora's like recommendation model where you put in an artist and it kind of recommends stuff. I can't remember what that's called. Maybe I'll put that in the blog post along with this podcast, but I'll have to try that out as well. But I don't
know. I think that's our topics. So we're on to news, right?
Let me just run through some of the quick I don't know what you call it here, my little spiel in the middle. If you want to keep up with our blog posts, feel free to check us out at blog.protocol80.com. That's where we post all of our posts throughout the week that we talk about in the podcast at the end of the week. You can always follow us on Twitter, of course, at twitter.com/protocol80, and that's protocol and the numbers 80. And send us an at reply, and we'll be sure to follow up. You can like us on Facebook if you go to facebook.com/protocol80. Again, that's protocol80. And then finally, if you want to subscribe to the podcast, we'd love to see that. You can search for it in iTunes. The easiest way is just to search for Protocol 80 and then go ahead and subscribe to the Protocol 80 Over Coffee podcast. And again, we apologize for missing last week, but we'll try to be a little more.
Tell your friends.
Tell your friends, absolutely.
Don't tell them that we missed last week. Just tell them that you love our podcast.
Tell them it's the best thing you've ever heard, even if you're lying.
It's an excuse for you to drink coffee late in the day.
That's right.
Or us to drink coffee late in the day.
Or to eat Twizzlers.
Yeah.
Whatever.
I like Twizzlers.
They're good. Do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I have two news stories.
So do I.
So I'll start, and then we'll go back and forth. I forgot what Donnie's was. I think we were going to talk about it, but I forgot what it is already. So.
Doesn't matter.
He'll have to use that next week, I guess. I'll start with the Motorola Zoom.
Yep.
That wasn't one of yours, was it?
No, it wasn't.
Just released. You can buy it without a Verizon thing for $800.
Yep.
Or $600 if you get the Verizon subscription. It's running on Honeycomb. It's the first tablet running on the Android 3.0, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, absolutely.
And 7-inch screen. Is it 7?
I think so.
I think I read a few comments that you had posted earlier in the week. There's no additional storage. Is that
right? There's no additional storage. There's no flash, which is kind of weird because that's one thing about the...
That's my phone. My sister had a virus on her computer, so I'm fixing her computer, and she's wondering where it is, probably. They had a snow day today, so she was probably bored out of her mind.
Yeah. God, that's what snow days are for.
Well, that's what happens when you click on links in, like, Sims games and stuff.
Yeah. One of the big things with that Android has over, especially iOS, in my opinion, is the flash. And so to see them not be able to include flash for whatever reason is kind of a bummer. And Donnie had mentioned that it might be the size of the device, but the Motorola Atrix, which is on AT&T, you can click it into either a dock for a TV or a dock for a laptop, and that's like a 10-inch screen at least, I think. So I don't know if it would be the display
I'm
size.
I'm not sure, and I don't – like with the Flash, you can go to like the Android market with the phones and just download the application. I doubt it would work because someone would have already thought of that by now. But there's other things, like you can get like Adobe Air through the market and stuff like that. I don't know.
I think it's interesting right now, Android devices in particular. I was surprised at the price of the Zoom. $800.
That's a lot.
It is a lot.
What about, have you read whether you can stream Netflix or not? Because I know Netflix uses Silverlight for streaming.
I don't know.
And I doubt that that's on there, but...
Right. I'm sure that's something that they're working on and something that they'll try to figure out for future versions. But seeing that the Zoom was $800, and then today I saw there's a new a phone... 4G phone coming called the Thunderbolt, the HTC Thunderbolt, and that's going to be $300 with a contract. So it's kind of interesting to see that the prices are a little more expensive lately.
I think we're going to start seeing more prices go up for smartphones than in the past, and we already saw Verizon did away with it, new every two. And
yeah, that sucks.
I think that with the cost, their cost of the smartphones going up a little bit, they're raising the cancellation rates and stuff like that. So I think we're going to start seeing the phones go up in price as well, which I don't really like.
I don't either. But I hate when prices go up on anything, though.
Yeah,
so.
Especially bread.
Yeah.
I hate paying $2.50 instead of $2.
It's the worst. My first story this week was about the new version of OS X, which is the operating system that runs on Macintosh computers out of the box. There's a new version called Lion. That's going to be the next version. And this week there was a developer preview where if you're a developer, you could apply to take a look and download and install a version of it. I think even if you're a non-developer, you can do something like sign up to be a developer for $99 or something, and then you get access to it and you can download and install it. And I think what they'll do with that, if you do decide to do that, I didn't, is they'll actually supply you with a Gold Master, which is basically a final version of the operating system when they're ready to start selling it. So if you're really eager to see it, you can check it out and apply to be a developer and download it for, I think, like I said, $99. But the important thing that I wanted to touch on was some of the user interface and application changes that Apple's making to make it more like the iPad. I looked at some of the comparisons in Lion, and some of the features that they're coming out with are like a new version of their standard mail application, a new version of the calendar application, a new version of the notes application, I believe. And all of those applications are almost, I won't say copy and paste jobs, but they look almost identical to the their counterparts that are on the iPad right now. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And they're also doing a new feature called full screen. So any application that you're working in, maybe it's not any, maybe it's just some of them, but you can blow them up to full screen size and just work in just one, that one single application, which again is kind of a way to replicate the experience you get on the iPad where you can only really run one application in a window at any given time. I don't know if I really like it as much. Especially like on my iMac, I have a huge iMac display, a 24-inch iMac display. I kind of like having the ability to, you know, use multiple windows in that. And I like it fine on my iPad, which is a much smaller device, but the whole iPadification, which isn't a word at all, but...
That is a word.
It's a word now.
It's a word now.
Go to Webster's. It's kind of discerning, and I don't know if I like it as much, but... When they were announcing Lion, I think it was like what they talked about was like kind of going back to the Mac. So they started with the Mac, They went to mobile devices with like the iPhone, then the iPad, which is kind of like in the middle. But
with iPadification.
iPadification. And then they iPadified the Mac experience. So they went back to the Mac. And a lot of people have been kind of up in arms, especially in the Apple community, about whether Apple might just start to focus on only mobile mobile devices and laptops and maybe not do desktop computers or maybe just focus on a mobile operating system. And
they have failed with desktops in the past. What was the one that just had everything in it and they had like colored backs to them? They were like blue backs.
Yeah, I know what you're talking
everything
about.
Everything that you had to do was with a USB.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
What were they called? They had like a name. They were like
The big ones?
They were big.
The CRT ones? I think they were like the very first iMacs.
Is that what they were called?
I think
just
so.
iMacs?
I think so.
Yeah. Those didn't go over too well.
No. No, and they've done some other dumb things. Like, there was I don't know if you remember, it was like a box. It was called the G4 Cube. It was just like a box like this, and you could lift, kind of like the Mac Mini, but you could lift out the computer, and it was just like this box thing.
I have a Mac Mini, and I love it.
Yeah, I do too. I like the Mac Minis.
I could use a new one, especially a free new one.
So, please send us free Mac Minis. But I don't know. Would you use like a mobile operating system on your desktop ever, or?
I don't know. It'd have to be really powerful.
Yeah.
I don't like slowness. My computer running like, you know, standard credentials or whatever you call those
right.
runs too slow for me. So it would have to be pretty speedy. But at the same time, I don't know, in things I've heard about Chrome OS, basically everything I do is on a web browser. So,
right.
you know, I don't know. I guess there's certain things to consider and it's possible that I would.
I don't know. Like I said, you won't be just limited to that in Lion, and they have some other cool features like Launchpad and stuff, but you can take a look at that if you're interested. That was my first news story of the day, one to come after Josh.
This one should be fairly short. I read an article on Mashable that said New York City building permits are getting QR codes, so if you go to a building that's really trashy and everything's falling off, the shutters are falling off, and the right. roof's caving in. You can go up and scan the QR code and see like what improvements are being made or what actions have been taken, violations cool. that have occurred. I think we need that in Bradford.
Yeah.
I think just about every house would have a QR code
on
it.
You know what we need to do? We need to QR code roads and put QR
That's
codes
right.
on the massive potholes.
If you've never driven in Bradford, it is an experience.
It is. It is.
It's
not great.
It's an interesting place to drive, and I think I tweeted or something a while ago that it's like, sorry, I have a cold. It's like an obstacle course because of the potholes. And then, like, even in the summertime, I don't know how to be politically correct about this. We have a lot of people that are using government funding for their jobs.
Right.
And for some reason, I don't know why, but they walk in the middle of the road. And I don't want to be mean about it, but there's sidewalks in Bradford.
Yeah.
Even if it's like the nicest sidewalk ever, there's a group of like five people walking in the middle of the road all the time.
That's a safety issue.
It's a safety issue, and I don't like it.
I don't either.
We're all about safety here.
That's right. You're looking out for them.
Have you noticed that in the summertime?
Oh, yeah.
I don't get it. Maybe I did that when I was a kid.
You know why? It's because we're so rebellious around here.
We are.
Can't be bound by sidewalks.
That's right. That should be the Bradford motto.
Right.
We'll start building our brand.
Yep.
I think we already have one. It's like, welcome to historic Bradford. I believe that's it.
What's on the one drum? Bradford, cool town, cool people, something like that?
Or cool town, cool hearts, or warm hearts.
Warm hearts.
Warm hearts, cool town.
I don't know. Something like that. It's obviously a really good one that sticks out in your mind.
And then we had a mascot a while ago that was Slick.
The
oil drop.
Yep.
Yeah.
That showed up on the Today Show or something?
No, it was the Daily Show.
The Daily Show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They definitely came and made fun of Bradford. They said that we take our tens and tens of dollars to the shopping mecca of Olean.
Yep, that's pretty much a fact. So my last story, this is kind of a specific story. If you're using an iPad, one thing that always kind of disappointed me about the iPad was that there was no native Facebook app. For whatever reason, Facebook decided to not make a native application for the iPad specifically. There is the iPhone application, and you can kind of blow that up to 2 times, and I don't really like the experience. So there have been a couple of third-party applications for Facebook in specific, and I haven't really liked very many of them. But this past week, I heard about one called Friended, and in my opinion, it's the best implementation of Facebook on the iPad. It does a really good job of kind of
here's to use that term again, iPadifying the Facebook experience. It's kind of new, so there's a little bit of slowness and maybe a few bugs here and there. But if you're on an iPad and you're looking for a better way to kind of interact with Facebook, I would highly recommend the Friended application. It's 99 cents in the App Store, so give it a try.
One last thing while we're on the subject of iPadification. You had mentioned earlier how much it costs to get an iPad app off the ground.
Yeah, that's one thing we talk about a lot in the office is like project price. And we also talk about like kind of weighing the benefits between doing platform-specific mobile applications. So say you were a tourism company and you wanted to make a mobile application that people could access on their phone. Should you focus on iPhone? Should you focus on Android or whatever platform you should you focus on? And moreover, it's weighing that cost against maybe developing a mobile website or an HTML5-based application, which will run on any smartphone or mobile device that has a modern web browser. And this week, Mashable posted something really interesting, and that's that to create an iPhone application from, you know, start to finish to actually deploy it, and I don't think this included any marketing at all, the average project price and project cost was $30,000. So that's just to have an application in the App Store on the iPhone. That's not, you know, counting Android or any of the other mobile device platforms. So if you were to make a native application for those other devices, I mean, you could easily be in the, you know, $100,000 range by the time everything was said. So I think that's another supporting factor of, you know, focusing on HTML5, especially because you can replicate so much of the functionality, and obviously you get the added bonus of being able to access that application on any of the devices that have a mobile web browser that's recent or at all modern. So that was a good story to bring up. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you, Mashable. We should call this the Protocol 80 over Mashable.
We should. So that's it. I think Donnie left, Josh changed right here before your eyes, and I think we're ready to wrap this thing up. Thank you very much for listening. Like I said, feel free to subscribe on iTunes by searching for Protocol 80 and hitting up the Protocol 80 over podcast, over coffee podcast. I can't speak. It's Friday. Follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook, like us on Facebook, and of course, keep up with our blog at blog.protocol80.com.
Thank you.
Thank you.